Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you know we are such stuff as dreams are made on, you know The Tempest. If you know Oh Brave New World, you know The Tempest. William Shakespeare's last great fantasy of rough magic and revenge took on the very power of the artist. Now Julie Taymor of Lion King and Spider-Man fame has taken on The Tempest, brought it to film, and made Helen Mirren the great sorcerer at the heart of the story.
Betwixt the green sea and the azured vault, set roaring war, to the dread rattling thunder have I given fire, and rifted Jove's stout oak with his own bolt.
This hour On Point, we're listening to The Tempest. You can join the conversation. Have you touched The Tempest lately? Seen its great sorcerer as a woman? Seen Julie Taymor's Helen Mirren in that role? What's at the heart of this great play for you? And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In just a few minutes, we'll hear direct from Julie Taymor, who's been struggling with the Broadway stage set of Spider-Man as her new film, The Tempest, comes to theaters. But first, to the play. Emily Mann, artistic director and resident playwright at Princeton University's MacArthur Theater Center, joins us from New York. She directed her own gender-swapping version of The Tempest in 2003 with Blair Brown in the leading role as Prosper Ra. Emily Mann, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Tom. Very nice to be here.
And with me in the studio is Stephen Greenblatt, general editor of the Norton Shakespeare, professor of the humanities at Harvard. He's author of Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare, and Hamlet in Purgatory. His new book just out is Shakespeare's Freedom. Stephen Greenblatt, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Hello, Tom. Nice to see you.
Emily, I'll come first to you, since Prospero is Prospera in this film. There's so much to dive into here, but for people who do not know the story, in the tiniest of nutshells, take us just to the narrative line.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think you did it so well earlier on in the intro, but I think what Julie and I have in common is that we put at the center of the story Prospera as Prospero, the great woman sorcerer and magician who had been betrayed in her native city and sent out onto a boat with her daughter and washed up on the shore and used her magic to somehow save herself. And by being on this island, brought up her daughter and pretty much controlled the island.
So the deposed Duke of Milan becomes the deposed Duchess of Milan, surviving and more than surviving here.
More than surviving, in fact, thriving, and has brought up her daughter to the age of maturity, really. And she has now, looking out, seen the vessel that goes by that she knows houses the people who had betrayed her, her own brother, and the king. Of Naples. And so she uses her great powers to make a tempest. And in that tempest, she makes them all wash up on shore. And she is going to exact revenge, she thinks, until she herself is transformed.
We'll look at all that, tempest included, the magic put in the hands, Stephen Greenblatt, of Prospero, or here Prospera, is quite enormous. What's the source in Shakespeare's telling of this sorcerer's magic in the world?
Shakespeare in his whole age was fascinated by the possibility of supernatural powers being focused in the hands of a great magician, magus, as they called it. Mm-hmm. And Prospero, here Prospera, is the master of this enormous supernatural power.
And she uses it very early in the play, of course. I mean, right off the bat, and in Julie Taymor's movie as well. Here's a little bit as things rage of Helen Mirren as Prospera, Duchess, deposed Duchess of Milan, or betrayed, telling her daughter Miranda the backstory of how they came to be on a secluded kind of fantastical island. Here you are.
So dear the love my people bore me. In few, they hurried us aboard a bark, bore us some leagues to sea where they'd prepared a rotten carcass of a boat. Not rigged, nor tackle, sail, nor mast. And there they hoist us, to cry to the seas that roared to us, to sigh to the winds whose pity sighing back again did us but loving wrong.
And there they are. And on come the betrayers. They're on their shore. Mm-hmm. Emily, in this case, on the Hawaiian island of, what was it, Lanai?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
I mean, it is a very, very stark physical setting in Julie Taymor's movie, mm-hmm. as dramatic as you might guess she would reach for. Stephen Greenblatt, what's at the heart of this story? What is this about? Is the Magus, is it the artist? Is it Shakespeare himself?
The heart of the story is anyone who possesses immense, unlimited power. And for Shakespeare, of course, it was probably as the greatest artist that we've known for the last several thousand years that embodied that possession of immense power. And then the idea of what you do with it, what you do with it when you have it, and what you do with it to get beyond it.
And what is it that she learns before it's all over, Emily, that takes her off finally the revenge path and somewhere much grander?
Well, you know, first of all, before I answer that, I just want to give such congratulations to Julie Taymor and the whole company, but especially Helen Mirren.
I mean, oh, my
gosh, yeah.
It's
just a stunning, stunning job. There's a beautiful scene, Act 5, Scene 1, between Ariel and Prospera, where she has gotten all of her, the three betrayers, all in a state of complete distraction. And Julie does it so beautifully. They're just, you know, fighting the air with all their guilt and anger over what they realize they've done.
With the help of Ariel, her sort of private
Ariel,
fairy here, who's all yes, over doing mischief
fairy.
And more on the island, played by
exactly.
Ben Whishaw.
Yeah, beautifully. And it is Ariel who puts in her mind the idea of forgiveness. She says, if you now beheld them, your affections would become tender. And Prosper says, dost thou think so, spirit? And Ariel says, mine would, madam, were I human. And then she goes on to make her decision. Though with their high wrongs I'm struck to the quick, yet with my nobler reason, gainst my fury, do I take part. The rarer action is in virtue than in vengeance.
The rarer
That's to
action.
Me, yeah.
Mm, in virtue than in vengeance.
Yes. They being penitent, the soul drift of my purpose doth extend not a frown further. Go release them, Ariel. So she makes the choice. It's the reversal in the play. It's the gorgeous transformation of rage, fury, vengeance into forgiveness.
Stephen, at the same time, this is often described as Shakespeare's last play, or maybe the last he wrote solo. Do you read him actually laying down his pen as Prospera puts down that staff of sorcery, magic?
Well, it's certainly an imagining of that. I don't think he did lay down his pen at that point. but I think, unquestionably, the play is charged with a sense of giving something up, giving up this remarkable power that he, of course, possessed, but in this case, his magician possessed. But there is, to pick up something Emily said, there is this crucial question that hovers over the film, I think, as a question, and maybe Emily and I would disagree about this. I think that the renunciation that Emily describes to work properly, you have to feel that it really is possible for Prospero to tear apart his enemies.
The renunciation of revenge.
Yes, mm-hmm. but to
yeah,
have that renunciation
disagree.
Work, you have to feel the full force of what it was to fall into the hands of your enemy in the in this period or in lots of parts of the mm-hmm. world now. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, though I hugely admire Helen Mirren, I don't know if I felt that capacity in her. She seemed quite noble and virtuous, how should we say, from the beginning. So I never felt actually that she would do what Henry VIII, Queen Elizabeth, King James actually routinely did to their enemies when they fell into their hands.
There's a great nobility about her. There's a great insight, I think, into women and power. You're talking about girl power. It's gigantic here. But what about it? Does it take some edge off the bloodlust, the revenge lust at the outset of this presentation, Emily?
Not to me, no. I mean, I think women are as capable of vengeance, rage, fury, and bloodlust as men. We've seen it throughout the ages. I think Helen Mirren made some choices that tempered that, though I think it was boiling inside of her. She kept it very cool. That was her decision. When I did it with Blair, it was much more passionate on that. Her anger was crackling, and her need to make a change, to make them feel what she had felt was very, very palpable. Helen Mirren was much cooler with that.
And then
we said that the Tempest, in fact, was her rage when it all crackled out there, that lightning and those bolts and that fire.
And it does look that way. And, of course, then when you make it a mother-daughter isolation upon this island instead of a father-daughter isolation, that moves it deeper into sort of thinking about women and their embrace relationship with the world and with one another.
I think that's true. It's not as if one is a better choice than the other. It's sort of who's the most perfect actor to play this at the time you're doing it, you know. And I think that Julie saw it as Helen, and I can understand that. And for me, it was Blair. And when you start the play with a mother-daughter play rather than a father-daughter play, you already have a different tonality. And also when a mother's bringing up her daughter and on the island is a young Caliban, who's also, she's bringing up, she brought him in to her cell with her daughter. And there's a sense of real love there between almost a mother and a son and a mother and a daughter. And then when he betrays her and tries to rape her daughter, then all hell breaks loose. And that's how we framed it. There was a rage there.
This is On Point. We're talking this hour about The Tempest, Shakespeare's late great fantasy of power, rough magic, revenge, and maybe renunciation. Now out from Broadway and film spectacularist Julie Taymor. Stephen Greenblatt is with us, the great Harvard scholar of Shakespeare. His latest book is Shakespeare's Freedom. Emily Mann is with us from New York, artistic director, resident playwright at the MacArthur Theater Center at Princeton University. She has directed The Tempest with a female in the role of Prospero. Now, Julie Taymor has as well. And Julie Taymor joins us right now from New York, writer, director, and producer of the new film The Tempest, starring Helen Mirren, which opened nationwide just this past weekend. Of course, The Lion King and many more before. She's currently at work on the musical Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, now expected out in February. Julie Taymor, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here, Tom. Thank you.
We want to hear all about The Tempest with you, but we have to ask about that Spider-Man. Are those guys jet-setting across the theater's rooftop yet, or is it working yet? Where are you?
Oh, yeah. No. It was all fine on the third preview. We're just doing our fixes and are cleaning up. And
no more broken bones as Spider-Man goes jetting around?
No.
Okay, good. Julie, what were you setting out to show us most importantly from The Tempest?
The Tempest. That was what was most important. It wasn't the idea of working with Helen on The Tempest just came about because I was looking for a great actor, and when I started to think about the role of Prospero, which I directed three times already with a male, it felt that this was the one Shakespeare play where it actually worked equally well, differently, but equally well with a woman in the role, and who better to do that than Helen Mirren, and she wanted to do it. So it really was to do The Tempest first and place it and try and be faithful to it, oddly enough, but that was the intention, and set it in a real location on an island, but also use the magic that is necessary to tell the story, and that was the major idea.
And why this role, this male Shakespeare role, as particularly open to being played by a woman as opposed to all others?
Well, because the idea of a duke, which also could be a woman in those days, who is attracted or involved with alchemy. And in that time, in Shakespeare's time, any woman who was practicing these kinds of sciences, whether they be white magic or the black arts, could be and would be accused of witchcraft. It felt like, because these issues of how far can you go with power, when is the point where you step over the line and it turns from benevolent to malevolent, and the abuse of power, this... It seemed like a very potent thing to talk about now, and that it would fit very well with the period. I've changed a bit of the backstory so that instead of having the Duke just be in his studies, irresponsible to his dukedom, therefore his brother finds a moment to usurp the dukedom from right under his nose. Mm-hmm. This time, the malevolent brother, Antonio, played by Chris Cooper, actually uses the accusation of witchcraft to have his sister deposed, and she is not burned. She is sent out on the bark with her little daughter. And when I was doing the research, I was surprised to find that one of the great speeches actually was lifted by Shakespeare from the mouth of Medea.
Ovid's Medea.
What? Mm-hmm.
Ovid's Medea.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The speech, ye elves of hills, standing brooks and groves, actually was from the mouth of the sorceress.
And whether it's back in, I don't know, 1610 or so when Shakespeare was bringing this out, or right now when you're bringing it out, what do you think is most valuable there for audiences to take away from this play?
Well, I think that there are many, many things, actually. Hold on, I've got a barking dog here. But
that's all right.
I think that what I was just talking about, which is the potential creative use of human imagination and power, is immense. And yet, at the same time, we have the ability to destroy, to take it to, well, you know, and this is not a new thing in our century, but it is something that is even more dangerous at this moment as we wreak havoc on our country, on our nation, on our world, on our environment. And the idea that we have such great power, and yet at the same time nature will take over all of us. I mean, I think that the fabulous speech about the cloud-capped towers that will disintegrate and finally ending in "we are such stuff as dreams are made on and our little life is rounded with a sleep" says it all. Mm-hmm. I've tried to frame the whole movie with the image of the dissolving sandcastle, that we build these castles of ours, we build these civilizations, but ultimately the storm, the tempest will come and it will dissolve in our hands. And I think that what I adore about working on Shakespeare, and what I love about this play as well, is that Shakespeare can be very correct about the duality of every human being. You don't love Prospera. She's the protagonist, but she's also the antagonist. You don't. Every single character has the positive and the negative. He doesn't make the simplistic good guy, bad guy syndrome, which we have way too much in our movies and books today, I think, or at least in our popular culture. I think the complexity of his characters makes us have to search deeper into ourselves, and that no other author is able to do, in my estimation. I think he's the best at that. So there are many, 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 many themes that are very potent for today.
Stephen Greenblatt, you know this work so well. What was running through your mind? I don't know, maybe your question for Julie Taymor as you watched her presentation. It's been presented how many times over how many centuries? Here's the latest.
I guess the question that I would ask Julie Taymor is how she decided to, because especially knowing now that she's directed it three times with a man, how she decided to transform the incest taboo, which hovers over the play, as she knows, hovers over a lot of late Shakespeare. Shakespeare is a man with daughters, and he worries a lot, not only in this play, but in other ones that he wrote late in his life, about how a father lets his daughter go. What does it mean to let a daughter go?
When it's Prospero,
Prospero
with his daughter Miranda.
With his daughter alone on an island in this highly charged and quite dangerous situation. In the case of the version of the play with Prospero as a male, when he says, "This thing of darkness I acknowledge mine," about Caliban, you know that in some sense he's acknowledging some connection between his own sexual feelings and what what his slave Caliban seems to have tried to enact. But when you remove all of that from the play, the question is there's a space, as it were, a psychic space that you need to fill. And I'm interested in how Julie Taymor imagined herself filling it.
Julie?
Well, I have to be honest, I don't feel that that's a very big part of it, the incest. I don't think it's evident in there. I think it can be projected upon it, but I think you can easily project many things, and that's what directors have done for the centuries with most of Shakespeare's plays, that you pick and choose what it is that you find worthy or most interesting to work on. In this case, I think by putting it as a mother-daughter, it's equally powerful in a very different way, because this mother, because she was a woman and was accused of witchcraft, was not allowed to take on the power that she had. She was sent to an island, exiled to an island with her daughter. And as her daughter comes of age and she is put next to Caliban or raised with Caliban, who pretty much almost rapes her, the mother feels incredibly responsible for that moment and understands at this point her daughter is in terrific danger because she's been brought up almost as a wild child. Mm. When Ferdinand comes, the young man comes,
young prince,
to to the daughter and falls in love with the daughter, the mother's reaction of a protection is even more severe than that of a father, because it's not about competition. It's about true protective mother, like a mother tiger to her, with her cubs. She's absolutely knows what her daughter is going to go through, and it's not just a battle of a father's competition or his testosterone. It becomes something else, and I think it's equal. I don't think one replaces the other. I think it's just a valid other way of looking at the story. The thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine, I take very differently. I see that she acknowledges that she has created the monster Caliban by making him the slave. That she, whatever grotesque behavior has happened, it's initially because she raised him in innocence, she taught him language, and then ultimately she came down on him. She usurped his island,
yes,
and she became the master.
Emily, we've just got Julie Taymor for another minute. Your thought, your question for this latest director of The Tempest.
Well, actually, I just wanted to congratulate Julie. I think you've done just a remarkable job. When I directed The Tempest with a woman in the center, I also made another change, and that was because I saw the mirrors of betrayal. I made certainly there's the brother sister betrayal with Prospero and her brother, and then there was the king and his brother, and I made it the queen and his brother, so that there was a mirror there, and then the women also had a bond when they felt they had to give up their children, and they had that sort of bond. But the thing that I love about what Julie is saying about this thing of darkness, I do acknowledge mine, is just what we were talking about at the beginning of the hour, that when you suddenly have a woman there, it is not, you know, these sort of ideas of incest, but in fact she brought him up as her own child, and her own child, she felt, betrayed her. And his mother also was a sorcerer or a magician, perhaps of the black arts rather than the white magic. But you have this idea of magical mothers and one child who then betrayed the trust of one mother, and the rage that comes out of that, that she throws him out of the home and imprisons him and enslaves him. And then where the colonialism comes in really is then he loved her and now he hates her, and she's upset that he would treat her this way. And of course we see this all the time reflected in the power plays that change around. So I guess I would ask Julie, when you made the change, having done it three times, did anything freshen up for you? Did you think of relationships in a new way that was exciting to you? Or did you just say, well, you know, it's really, a woman can be a duchess rather than duke, a woman can be a magician, you know, she can be a parent, a mother rather than a father. Did it open up new channels for you?
Completely. I really mean it when I said this was not any kind of, quote, feminist tract or any reason to do this other than I wanted to work with a great actor in the role and felt that the play would work in most of its manifestations with a woman in the role. And I was very aware of your production, Emily, and that this wasn't the first time by by a long shot that this has been done. I mean, Shakespeare had men in all the female roles, and I don't think that he was trying to say anything about women and men in those days. But now, having done it, and when we, once we started to work on it, as you say, many things opened up. Because it is very interesting for us at this time in our culture to still deal with women in those kinds of powerful places. It was very interesting when I changed the language from the he's to she's that I could not find an equivalent for the word master in the English language.
Oh, I had the
mistress
same problem.
Mistress
does
not.
Doesn't do it.
Is not the equivalent of master.
Right.
So that meant that on the island, in isolation, this character of Prospera had this duality. It once outside of organized civilization in Milan, in her own civilization, she created a new one. That's why the costumes that Sandy Powell designed had this androgynous freedom about them. And one of my favorite moments is when she asked for her Duke's garbs to come back, you know, her clothing from the court to be returned to her.
Just as it was.
Puts the corset on. And what that means, every third thought shall be my grave, going back to Milan, the kind of power that she will be giving up is not the same that Prospero would have had when he returned to Milan.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, we discovered the same thing. What a fabulous dress, by the
way. And it's an incredible, it was a discovery for us as we did it. It was something that it was not intended at all to be a gimmick. It's kind of wonderful that Emily and other people now will feel that women of a certain age can play another really powerful role in the Shakespeare canon, which is, always feels good. But I think that I had audiences who've never seen The Tempest come to see this film. So they didn't know it was ever a man. So these issues go out the window. It just becomes a fantastically interesting female role.
We had the same thing.
We had the same thing happen. People, not everybody's read or seen The Tempest. They come and they just say, wow, what a fantastic role by Helen Mirren. You know, what a performance and what a story.
And not just renouncing revenge, not just going back to the world, but having to put on the corset as a woman as she does that.
Yes. Having to, when she goes so, and that corset is tightened. She says right at the top of the play, everything I do for thee, my daughter, thee, my dear one. Everything is for her daughter at this point. It's not for her own ego. It's not to resume being Duke when she gets back. It's all about her child. And I think that that's a very strong, strong feeling. And watch this woman almost go over the point to vengeance and black magic, and yet being held back by the spirit Ariel is also... I think when you have a woman in the role of Prospera, then I always had a female Ariel with my male Prosperos. It's the usual. It's what most people do. Here, having Ben Whishaw as Ariel created another interesting sexual, sensual dynamic.
Androgynous.
Androgynous, but male.
Yes, certainly.
And male in not a, you know, any kind of cliched male way. That's where I think it's fun to play with the gender issues, because you have a very powerful, I wouldn't say masculine Helen Mirren, because she does. She has both. She has
heavens
the vulnerability.
No, yeah. How jealous we are of your sorcerer's situation, where you get to cast all these people and have all this going. And Russell Brand is the jester, flying 16 ways to Sunday at every minute. Wow.
Yeah, he was magnificent.
We're out of time with you, Julie, and we know that we're grateful for you taking the time to be with us today. Good luck with this. Good luck with your everything you've got going on. Spider-Man there and the Magic Flute at the Met this season, from Julie Taymor. Julie, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Whether be success or cause. In a cowslip spell I lie. There I couch when owls do cry. On a bat's back I do fly. After summer, merrily, merrily, merrily shall I live now. Under the blossom that hangs on the bough.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about The Tempest, Shakespeare's late great fantasy of power, rough magic, and its surrender, revenge, and its renunciation. Play now out from Broadway and film spectacularist Julie Taymor, and our thanks to her for joining us just now. We're very lucky to have Stephen Greenblatt with us, great Harvard Shakespeare scholar, author most recently of Shakespeare's Freedom, and from New York, and artistic director and resident playwright at the McCarter Theater Center at Princeton University, Emily Mann. McCarter won the 1994 Tony Award for Outstanding Regional Theater under her leadership. She directed The Tempest with Blair Brown in the role of Prospera back in 03. David's calling from Quincy, Massachusetts. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks. I guess it's possible to try to heap too much on to Shakespeare. He can absorb so much, but I'm always fascinated by one of the aspects of this play, one of the historical roots of it, giving it maybe the only American connection to any of Shakespeare's plays was his last play. And
The Tempest. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, in the sense that there was a famous shipwreck on Bermuda of a party of people, a second wave of settlers going to Jamestown, and a lot of people died. There was this one character, John Rolfe, who was about 25 at the time, and his wife and daughter died on the island of Bermuda. Kind of a heroic rescue. They built themselves some new ships on Bermuda. They continued on to Jamestown, where John Rolfe met and married Pocahontas. This is all true, believe it or not.
maybe, yeah.
He then went back to London with Pocahontas, where I'm interested in knowing whether Professor Greenblatt knows whether Shakespeare ever became met her or became aware of her. But what's also fascinating about John Rolfe is that when he returned to Virginia, he was not only the first American to cultivate tobacco, but he was also the first American to import African slaves to the Virginia colony. And I'm just wondering whether Shakespeare was aware of any of this, or does this resonate for Professor Greenblatt in the play at all?
David, it's terrific. Let us pick it up. I mean, it is quite a passage of history. It does leave us wondering if Shakespeare and this traveler ever sat over a crackling fire in 17th century London and the old, William getting stories and them showing up here. What do you say, Stephen?
What resonates for Shakespeare, I think, pretty clearly is the story that you already alluded to, David, of the shipwreck on Bermuda. That Shakespeare knew from a letter that was being circulated back in London before he wrote the play, and possibly also, as Tom says, from conversations that he could have had with people, but principally from this letter. And the point about the shipwreck is that once that ship landed, beached on Bermuda, and those who survived looked around and realized they were in Bermuda, they didn't want to behave themselves any longer. They didn't want to submit to authority. There were continual grumblings that culminated in the leader of a kind of incipient rebellion telling the commander to kiss my etc., mm-hmm. as is described in the 1610 text. Mm-hmm. And for saying that, he was tried and shot.
Oh.
And that was
a
when...
A different day.
He was killed at the end of that day. And that was the decisive move that enabled the colonists to build those ships and go on to Virginia to continue the colonial enterprise. But hovering over the whole play, Shakespeare's play, when he thinks about these materials, are a set of questions. How do you justify one person's rule over another?
Yes.
Why do people
mm-hmm.
submit to authority? What keeps things going when the ship hits a reef?
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, who is the civilized man and who is the barbarian?
No kidding. And that tension, I mean, you simply can't miss it in any telling of The Tempest. I want to play just a little bit from Julie Taymor's version. And here, Caliban, whose island this was, now the slave of Prospera, played by Helen Mirren. Caliban, played very powerfully by Jamin Hansu here, claiming right to the island, which was once ruled by his own mother.
Thus wicked Jira's heir, my mother, brushed with raven's feather from unwholesome fen, drop on you both. Southwest blow on ye and blister you all over.
For this,
Be sure tonight thou shalt have cramps, side stitches that shall pin thy breath up. Urchins shall work all exercise on thee. Thou shalt be pinched as thick as honeycomb, each pinch more stinging than bees at maiden.
This island is mine!
It may be, but Helen Mirren's Prospera, bringing down all the power of her magic to keep him in his place. And you've got a reading that may go right on from there, Stephen.
Yes, first of all, it's worth noticing that he's kept in place by torturing him.
Yes.
By sending her agents to torment him.
Old-fashioned torment of the slave.
And then he's a marvelous actor, this Jimon Hunzu, but I think born in Benin in Africa. Mm-hmm. And he explodes, this island's mine by Sycorax, my mother, which thou takest from me. And then goes on to explain that when they first came, he treated them with extraordinary hospitality, giving them food,
and her daughter.
Giving them food and protection, loving them, showing them where all the food on the island
fresh
was.
Fresh water and the fertile ground on this rough island, yeah.
Exactly. And then he says, as a result of this, now he's being penned, styed in a hard rock and made to be their slave. He has, Shakespeare allows, quite remarkably, allows Caliban to explode with the sense of injustice that has been visited upon him.
Is that progressivism of the 17th century, Emily? Is this the leading edge at that time?
Well, I would just like to say that there are four other lines there. When once you have a woman in the role, it sort of thickens the soup, if you will. It's really, really emotionally and sexually very, very complicated. He says to her, when thou camest first, thou strokest me and made much of me, which give me water with berries in it and teach me how to name the bigger light and how the less that burn by day and night. And then I loved thee. So it's very complicated, this relationship.
As a mother, as a lover,
yeah,
we don't know.
All of that. Mm. And there's, you know, talk about the sexuality that goes between them. Mm-hmm. She's stroking him. She's caring for him. He's growing up into this, you know, fish Jimon, a gorgeous, hugely beautiful man. Mm-hmm. What's the sexual tension there? And then they turn on each other, especially when he betrays her by trying to rape her daughter. So what you have when she says, this thing of darkness, I do acknowledge mine, you have a really, really complicated admission of collusion, in a way.
But is Shakespeare or Tamar, in this telling, you know, justifying that power and powerless relationship? Or in giving that full voice, as Stephen Greenblatt puts it, to Caliban, is he calling it out as far as it might be called out in his time?
Oh, yeah. I think she's exposing it in all its different facets, just telling the truth. He wrote it. All you have to do is commit to each one of those facets, and we see a multi-faceted gem that tells us about occupation, colonialism, power, the oppression of others, and the liberation and the need to be free. He's done it all for us.
But the power is certainly given to the master there as well. Bruce in New Haven, Connecticut. Bruce, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, well, you know, I'm so happy that you're talking about this particular speech that begins, "This island's mine" by Sycorax, my mother.
Yes, Caliban's speech.
Because of that Prospero, you know, as a man, you know, has usurped his mother, his beloved mother. And now as a woman, this is sort of fascinating to me. But also at the very end of that speech, he says, and takes from me the rest of the island. And it occurs to me recently that maybe the rest of the island wasn't just, you know, the other parts of the island, but actually the sleep of the island, you know, his comfort, his ability to rest. You know, that he had with his mother there.
He's a working slave in this case.
Although he does say that in famous lines that you, Bruce, will remember, because you know the play well, he does describe those incredible dreams that he continues to have while he's a slave, dreams in which he's being showered with the very things that he's being kept from. During his daylight
hours. Sycorax, his mother, was no joy to him, and she had him trapped away. Prospero reminds him again and again in every version that she freed him.
Ariel, but not Caliban. Sycorax was no gift to Ariel, but
Ariel. Yeah,
Sycorax presumably was. We don't know much about Sycorax's mothering of Caliban, but he regrets her death.
Let's get thank you, Bruce, for your call. Jesse in Brookline, Massachusetts. Jesse, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. So I just want to speak a little bit to my first experience of this play. I put it on in, actually for a high school production, and we had a Prospera as well.
Oh. But, I saw it, Jesse. I saw it at Brookline High School. It was terrific.
Oh, great.
Oh, wow.
Something else that made our production really unique was we had the initial enchantment. The effect of this enchantment was taking away language from the nobility, and so we translated the first scene, as you may remember, into Spanish, and then for the rest of the show, the high schoolers had rather interesting Spanish accents, but they were forced to speak in English, and so I felt that this effect it was very interesting because as these characters are trying to express themselves, the effect of them not being able to speak in their natural language kind of gives a barrier maybe to what they may want to say.
Jesse, I appreciate your call very much. Our time grows short here. I want to give a little range to some language here that was working pretty hot in the movie and in the play when it comes to love. And here's a scene, this again is from Julie Taymor's version, where the daughter, Miranda, played by Felicity Jones, a sort of naif, wild child, beauty, and Ferdinand, Prince of Naples, shipwrecked with his father and Moor on the island, played by Reeve Carney, they're falling in love as Prospera watches on.
Full many a lady I have eyed, with best regard. Many a time the harmony of their tongues hath into bondage brought my too diligent ear. For several virtues have I liked several women. You, oh you, so perfect and so peerless.
Our features are abroad, I am skinless off but by my modesty. I would not wish any companion in the world but you.
No companion in the world but you. And, of course, this is the Miranda who, when she suddenly sees all these people on the island, she hasn't ever seen such a gathering before, comes out with her, oh, brave new world that has such people in it. And her father, or mother in this case, responding just, 'tis new to thee, but hardly new. What did you think of the love relationship here, Emily?
Oh, I thought it was really wonderful to see. I think they both did beautifully. Felicity clearly was able to look at him. She'd never seen a man before because now she had her father in the old version, but if you have only your mother and then the only man she ever saw was Caliban, here's the first young man that she saw with whom she was attracted. I mean, Caliban was brought up almost as her brother who tried to rape her. So this is a heart-stopping moment for her to view Ferdinand. And you think that's gold in theater when you're playing it as an actor. You look for that discovery of something that's utterly new. And so also you see it again when she sees all of the men at the end. She's dumbstruck to see them all. And she has a brave new world that has such creatures in it. Oh, all these marvelous, gorgeous-looking men. Well, then it's real irony, I think, when Prospero or Prospera says, 'tis new to thee. I mean, this is nothing to
only
be,
you, girl.
So,
only
oh, yeah,
you.
Really. You'll soon find out they're not so wonderful. And I think that having it be, you know, more of a shock of even what they look like is Julie did wonderfully with.
And just a little more that's not so serious here. Russell Brand, as the jester, is here, as Trinculo, discovering in this little scene Caliban lying on the ground, covered up, and as a storm approaches, crawling under the covers with this creature.
This is no fish, but an islander that hath lately suffered by a thunderbolt. Alas, the storm has come again. My best way is to creep under his gabardine. There is no other shelter here about. Misery acquaints a man with strange bedfellows.
Talk about a kind of pop icon these days. Julie Taymor, Stephen, not afraid to mix up the pop and the grand and the storied here.
I thought that the winner of that particular group was Alfred Molina, I mean, who plays the butler. Stefano comes on on them. To go back to the colonial moment, what you get at that conjunction is something that was feared, that continues to be feared in colonial situations. How do you keep the lower classes from joining up with the oppressed natives? And that's the mythical scene, as it were, that you're getting here, where you get an alliance between the grunts on the ship, who are also oppressed and exploited labor, and the native who was expressed in the exploited labor, and that's what's defeated in the course of the play. Mm.
Emily, you know, you're finally left with the image in this telling of Helen Mirren throwing the staff of her magical powers into the sea, and for a woman in that age to lay that down, that is something different from Prospero, the male laying that down. I mean, what were you taking away at that moment?
Oh, what I took away had nothing to do with that, actually. I think it's the great artist, the great magician, she's she or he, at a certain point in your life, mm-hmm. when do you say, okay, I'm putting it down.
It's done.
I'm no longer, yeah, mm-hmm. it's done. I'll drown my book. And perhaps Shakespeare was saying, you know, I think I'm going to retire. I don't think it's that simple. I think any person who has had great power, or whether it's intellectual or artistic or political, to say, all right, I'm going to put that down, and now every third thought will be my grave. I mean, that you're going to let it go. That's, you know, human. It will resonate to the end of time.
Is there sorrow, Stephen Greenblatt, for a Shakespeare scholar at the moment when the bard brings us that perspective? I'm going to lay down this power.
What is very strange to me about that last moment of the play is the strange sense of queasiness or guilt that Shakespeare manages to invest this renunciation. He says, his character says at the end, as you from crimes would pardon be, by your indulgence set me free. As if toward the end of his life, Shakespeare felt that there was something strangely transgressive or criminal about what he had been doing.
That he had done with his greatest of literary careers.
Exactly.
And you really think he felt that?
I do actually think he felt
that. Well, because he'd crossed boundaries so many times, because he toyed with us?
I think he felt that there was... I think he reveled in his power. He adored it. But also, I think he felt that there was something demonic about it.
Well, and maybe that, when the power is so great, is inevitable. It's certainly amazing to see it played out with storm and storm-tossed seas and the story of The Tempest retold. Critics have not all loved it, not by any means, but it is a great play, a great story in all times. I'm so grateful to the two of you for listening and looking in with us today. Emily Mann, joining us in New York from the MacArthur Theater Center at Princeton. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Stephen Greenblatt, author of Shakespeare's Freedom. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
This is On Point.